meeting with you, we thought it might be an opportunity for us to get together and talk about some of these things.
That's good. You signed a complete amateur in me. I don't know whether you can find anything you need to interest people in your profession.
Well, I think that we've decided that maybe we're the amateurs in a great many respects.
Some of your people that you select, of course, they're unusual people in a way. Do you select them as unusual, or as a type that seems to appeal to you?
I doubt if I know whether I select these people or they select me. I think that the writer is trying to take some comic or tragic moment of man in his struggle inside the human condition and tell it in some form which other people would find comic or tragic. As far as I know, I am dealing simply with people in the condition that I have seen people. That these people, to me, seem quite sane and quite normal. Even the ones that are mad seem to me quite sane people. Probably that's because the writer has already accepted the premise that the man believes he's Mahatma Gandhi, so when he lies on a boat full of tacks, he's a rational creature.
I'm mad, you mean what? Society.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The character in the book, as I lay dying, Dahl, one of the sons, was mad, as society would call him mad. To me, he wasn't mad. Or that is, I didn't set out to say, now one of these brothers will have to be mad, so I will invent a good mad one according to what I do know of the rules of insanity. I was just writing about what was to me a pitiable, tragic human being.
Have you had many much experience in state hospitals?
None whatever.
No.
None whatever. I think you don't need to go to state hospitals to find people that society calls mad.
There certainly seems to be a common denominator of interest. So often, a psychiatrist who is interested in much of the same area of human function comes out in so-called madness, or the different individual who portrays these things. Seems to me a very definite similarity in at least perception, interest on the part of the novelist and the psychiatrist, perhaps, in this vein.
I should agree with you, yes, sir.
Mr. Parker, could you say a few words about what you might consider as irrational human behavior?
No, I couldn't. I've never tried to set up what might be a pattern for me to measure irrational human behavior. To me, all human behavior is unpredictable, and considering man's frailty in the ramshackle universe he functions in, it's all irrational. It couldn't be very rational because his universe is not a very rational one, it seems to me. I think that probably no writer would set himself up to judge. If he begun to judge the people he writes about, his all the whatever the gods are that to let him do something which is his cup of tea he likes, might withdraw the gift. But if we began to preach or proselytize or pass judgments, that the fire might go out. Also, I think the writer is not really interested in bettering man's condition. He really doesn't care damn about man's condition. He is interested in all man's behavior with no judgment or whatever. That it's motion, it's life. The only alternative is nothing, it's death. And so to the writer, anything man does is fine because it's motion. If he were not doing that, he would be nothing, be dead. Maybe the writer has no concept of morality at all, only an integrity to hold always to what he believes to be the facts and truths of human behavior, not moral standards at all, but that man in his books does what man will do, not what man should do, but what he will do, maybe what he can't help but do.
Is the writer's motivation then simply just a portrayal of that which most people see but perhaps don't take in?
Did you say the writer? No, I think that his aim is maybe more specific. He simply wants to make something which wasn't here yesterday. There's not much that he can do. He can take only the older struggles of man within the human predicament, and by showing it slightly awry or with some faint new light from an individual perception, make something which was a little different from what was here before. That is what the writer ahead of him did. There's nothing new he can write about. I think that's maybe the writer's denial of mortality of death, that he's going to write on the wall, "Kill all this here."
Theoretically, the psychiatrist also does not make judgments. He simply takes man as he is and life as he is and tries to understand it. And yet, to say so, we think we would be kidding ourselves if we do nevertheless look at these things from our own perspective. And certainly when the idea comes in of trying to do anything about it, which you say the writer doesn't do, and which we theoretically do attempt to do, attempt to better the situation, you've got to think in terms of bettering it to what aim or what goal, and those are essentially the goals that we ourselves would hold at the present time, or at any given time. Can a writer really avoid personal judgment or value systems?
He can, as long as he is a writer. I think that a writer is a perfect case of split personality. That he is one thing while he's a writer, and he is something else while he's a denizen of the world. It may be that he can't be really that split, that maybe he has a hope that what he does may improve man in the sense that it will give to man some instance of man's fine record, being fragile and frail and not his own boss by any amount of means, yet out of that he has managed somehow to endure, to have accomplished a few things which have lasted. Maybe in that sense, the writer has got to work for man's betterment, even if he's not deliberately trying to. I think that, in a way, the psychiatrist is doing that too. That I imagine a psychiatrist with one human being could learn about all he would need to know about what makes man do what he does. And he would stop then, and since he will devote his life to it, he must have some thought that somehow he will improve in the end man's condition.
What is your idea of what makes man do what he does?
I think that man is trying to do what he does because he wants to, that he himself does not always know why he wants to. It makes him feel good. It makes his glands function right. People do foolhardy, reckless, dangerous things because it makes the glands flow good, makes them feel good. I think that man is not a gambler just to get a lot of money, that he gets some pleasure. His system works good when he is engaged in taking chance for money or using his skill to gain money. The money is just a symbol of it. I think he would be a gambler if he were, had to gamble for matches. I would say that man does what he does because he wants to. No, sir, I don't. Only what I have learned about it from listening to people that do know. What little of psychology I know, the characters I have invented, and playing poker have taught me. But Freud, I'm not familiar with.
You apparently
believe in an extra-sensory perception of it. Yes, I probably depend almost completely on it. I don't have a trained mind. I've got to depend on extrasensory perception.
Something perhaps about your acquaintanceship with some of the people who have been the prototypes for the characters in your writing. I'm just wondering how you got to know them so well, in a way, to have been able to depict their thoughts. I think this is related to Dr. Wilson's idea about the subconscious.
Yes, so that would be through an unflagging curiosity about people, interest in what people are doing, how they do it, and what they say. Not with any desire to study people, nor to store up material to work from, but out of simple curiosity, I reckon. Though it may be that no man could be that disinterested in the material he works from. Maybe that any writer's something like a pack rat. He gathers up every scrap he sees on the chance that someday he may need it, and sure enough, there it is. The characters, I think, are composite of experience, observation, and imagination, but nobody could say just how much of which goes into it. I'm convinced, though, that no writer's going to be satisfied just to use people as he saw them, because he's convinced that he can do a better job of creating credible people than the Lord can. He always improves on them. And he's also probably a congenital liar. That's why they call it fiction, I suppose. He probably couldn't tell the truth on any subject.
Do you actually make notes of people who arouse your curiosity?
No, so I never did any research, never made any notes. I have a lot of faith in my memory. If I can't remember, it wasn't worth keeping it anyway, probably.
Miss Fox, did I understand correctly when you said that you thought if a psychiatrist took a man and was capable of knowing him well enough or understanding him well enough, he would know about the nature of man more as much as you would otherwise for example, studying people as a group or as a culture?
I would assume so, but then I don't know. I'm ignorant, as I say. I have no training in psychology or psychiatry. I would assume that a psychiatrist could learn as much about man from one man as a surgeon could about man from one cadaver. That's probably wrong. That's my assumption.
How much influence, for example, in your portrayal and creation of people, how much influence does a given culture have in determining this person that you make or write about?
It have a great deal of influence, but mostly on the surface. It would influence his idiom, his surface actions, his manners. But I would say if you went deep enough, he would look a good deal like the same individual of his age and physical condition in some African culture.
You don't deliberately use symbolism.
I suspect the writer's too busy to deliberately use anything, even good grammar, that he is simply trying to get something down, and he's completely immoral. He will rob and steal from any source he finds, just like the pack bag, against the day when maybe he'll need it. And writing out of a culture which has a certain symbol, in time he will reproduce those symbols without any deliberation. That's not himself, not his own erudition. It was simply the culture which was the environment he grew up in, and maybe something of his heredity which produced. But I think any writer is too busy dealing with people, and people are incredible and in motion. All the writer can do once the characters come to life is to run at top speed behind them and try to put down everything they do and say before they get out of sight, out of hearing, that he hasn't got time to use symbols deliberately.
What's your characters are certainly highly individualized human beings. Do you have any particular ideas on the so-called trend toward conformity or loss of individualization in our current society?
Yes, I have very definite ideas about that, and if I ever become a preacher, it will be to preach against man, individual man, or relinquishing into groups. Any group. I'm against belonging to anything. So when I was young, I belonged to young people's fraternities and things like that, but now I don't want to belong to anything except the human race.
Why is that?
I think that there's too much pressure to make people conform, and I think that one man may be first rate, but if you get one man and two second rate men together, then he's not going to be first rate any longer, because the voice of that majority will be a second rate voice. The behavior of that majority will be second rate. And I think that a second rate man, to state himself, at least won't be third rate. But no second rate man is going to become first rate just by joining one or two more first-rate people.
Could you go further and say how you rate people like that, first and second rate?
Well, so that would be a little difficult and maybe a little trite. I would say that a first-rate man is a man that did the best he could with what talents he had to make something which wasn't here yesterday, and also to that never hurt an inferior, never harm the weak, practice honesty and courtesy, and tried to be as brave as he wanted to be, whether he always was that brave or not. I think that a man that held to those tenets wouldn't get very far if he were involved in a group of people that had relinquished their individuality to some one voice which could control their behavior.
Feel like that man is, you might say, by nature first rate or second rate, and influences or circumstances lead to his being what he is. By nature being one, being other, in other words, man by nature has to pull himself up or to first rate, being a first rate person, or man by nature would be a first rate person. And some are pulled down to being second-rate people.
I would say that he would have to pull himself up to be what I have premised as a first-rate human being, that the child is not born a first-rate human being in that sense, because the child is still a savage until a little boy is not civilized till he about 13 or 14 when he falls in love with his teacher. He teaches him to wash his face, behave like a member of the human race. I don't believe that all people are born equal, if that's what you mean. All people are not born second rate or tenth rate. That some people may be incapable of ever becoming first rate. But that would be possibly, yes, it has to be heredity, because environment could be changed. And if there's only environment that held people second, that would change. But some people are born incapable of being first rate.
Freedom that you insist on interests me a great deal. It seems to me that that's where much of the psychiatry goes astray, is in the loss of freedom to think and act and so forth as we would if we were totally free, or as you say, relinquish our individuality. Aside from joining the thing, do you find that the constant task of maintaining freedom, or is it something that comes natural to you? In other words, are you a natural rebel against convention or conformity?
I don't know whether I believe that such things are natural rebel. I think that man's impulse, that man really doesn't want to be free, that he is willing to relinquish his freedom to anyone that will give him bread and circuses, that it takes a certain amount of education or precept by someone old and wiser to make a young man value freedom enough to struggle for it. It's very easy for him to submit to the constant pressure from the people who have got to sell him something in order to keep an economy of waste in motion like ours, to be free. He's an anachronism. He's a fly in that ointment. And whether he had an impulse to be free, that impulse will not be enough in a young man against all the concerted, organized pressure to make him relinquish freedom into the hands of whoever runs the finance company that collects on his automobile, or compels him to be married in order to sell another dishwashing machine to somebody.
Now, don't you think that if we know in individual experiences, which is very difficult to do, but if we just say that
ideally, we know all the experiences that a person has had. Don't you think that we can predict his behavior?
I would think if anybody could predict his behavior, it would be the psychologist, the psychiatrist.
I mean, don't you think that a person, what he does, is based on the way he has been raised, the experiences he has had in the past, are they important in his conduct or what he does or what he says?
I would to an extent, and also to an extent, what he does at the moment is his environment is responsible for it. That he would have impulses which his heredity may have taught him to keep down, but his environment may have released him from the prohibition. That if you change his environment, he might behave differently. It wouldn't alter what he wanted to do. But probably any morality is simply a system of enabling man to say no to himself.
Well, with this loss of freedom, conformity, materialism, and so forth, how optimistic or pessimistic do you feel about our current culture as we see it today?
Well, pessimism is, I don't like to accept that term because I have a great belief in man. He has survived the dinosaur, and I'm convinced he will survive his atom bomb. I'm convinced that the last sound on Earth will be two people building an airship, arguing about where they're going next. I have a great faith in that.
Well, specifically in terms of our so-called Western culture.
It's an unpleasant one. It's a nuisance to have to live through, but the only alternative is to get out of it. You can't. It won't last any more than the other culture. And this one, as soon as we have used up the last of the natural resources, we have another one. This is, we are living in an economy of waste. To buy a new one next year, we'll clutter the earth up with the automobiles and washing machines we turned in order to buy a new one, then that may create jobs, or maybe the scientists will invent some way to vaporize all these things. And that would be something for General Motors. They could have a gas that would vaporize every car on the street. And you just sitting there with the steering wheel in your hand, nothing, buy a new car and start over again. Just that, or find the choke bags up and build a roof on it and start over. Well, I just said that the writers don't ever stop. People ask me what time of day I work, and I say all the time.
Sir, I ask you to discuss very briefly the character of Monk in the light of his freedom and inevitability and compassion as well.
Monk, he was the... I don't reread this, and I'll have to remember just who Monk was right now.
I don't
know. Oh, yes, the one that went to the penitentiary, was sent to the penitentiary. Well, he was probably a moron that just wanted to get along, just wanted enough to eat, and probably liked for people to speak kindly to him. He got involved in a crime which he didn't commit, was sent to the penitentiary, and was used as a tool by an evil man that wanted to get revenge on the warden. He was innocent, and innocence possibly has no safe place in this world. That you can't be that innocent and survive in it. That you've got to have a little of evil in your nature to cope with the world, with mankind.
Thank you. changes chiefly through economic changes, the educational measures, for example, have relatively little impact.
No, I think that he withstands economic changes pretty well. And the only thing that will help him or change him, or in my opinion, is education. If we ever do get education in this country, I mean the schools that children go to. But that is the hope.
Some of us have been very interested in the psychological aspects of segregation. Be interested to know whether you believe that hope for that problem lies in education.
I think if we improve the schools, integration of schools would solve itself. I think that if the schools were up to the standard of the best that went there, only the best could stay, and the ones that were in it would be so busy working they wouldn't have time to bother about what color who was sitting next to them. And my hope is that all this uproar over integration will improve schools to that point. To get rid of the emotional problem, the old folks will probably have to die off. The tragedy is that right now white people and colored people simply do not like and trust each other.
One of the greatest defects you see in our current education system, other than this mediocrity mass leveling.